Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com. This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with Dr. Kirsten Sanford, episode 22 for November 16th, 2009, Earthquakes. This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much.
Kevin Maeda is a seismologist at UC Berkeley's Seismological Laboratory. And pay no attention to the earthquakes in the room being caused by Leo. He has lived here in the Bay Area all of his life, studied geophysics at Cal, went on to earn his PhD at USC with late Professor Kai Aki after working for years at Lawrence Livermore National Lab on earthquake source physics and nuclear explosion monitoring research. That sounds like fun, too. He's returned to Berkeley, to Cal Berkeley, is now a research seismologist, and he focuses on seismic hazard, earthquake dynamics, and public outreach. So the public outreach part is why we're so lucky to have him here in the studio with us. He's an avid golfer, runner, and cook. Hopefully he didn't run all the way here from the East Bay, although it would have been good
exercise.
You'd
have to be really avid to do that.
Very avid. And he spends his weekends on soccer fields, either as a referee or watching his daughters play for the Bay
neat.
Oaks. It's great. Thank you. Yeah, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here.
Yeah. I guess to get started, I mean, the news has reported over the last year, research has started to come out about the probability of earthquakes occurring here in California generally, but here in the Bay Area specifically. And the numbers are something like a 63% likelihood of a big earthquake.
Somewhere in the Bay Area.
Right.
That's right.
But the Hayward Fault is really stressed out.
That's exactly right. Actually, the next big one that most of us think is going to happen is actually going to be on the Hayward Fault. And the reason for that is that historically, for the last 2,000 years, there's been at least 12 large, when I say large, I mean magnitude 6 to 7 size earthquakes on the Hayward Fault.
Okay.
And they seem to go off with fairly regular periodicity, so about 140 to 160 years on average. The last several earthquakes have been about 140 years spacing.
Okay.
And so that 1868 was the last big earthquake on the Hayward Fault. And so if you add 140
Ooh,
to 1868, we're right in that window.
Right.
Now,
years.
There's obviously, you know, a lot of variation in those numbers. And certainly within, you know, my kids' lifetime, I think it's pretty clear that they will experience a big earthquake if they choose to stay in the Bay Area. But, you know, there's a lot of things that we've learned, you know, because we do live in earthquake country. You know,
right.
We do a lot of things to prepare. Building codes are definitely a lot different here than they are in, let's say, other parts of the world.
Right.
And,
so what is it that makes the Bay Area so special in terms of earthquake likelihood? I mean, here versus the Midwest, say. Why do we have more earthquakes, and why, when we have them, are they potentially bigger? Are they so much bigger?
Sure. Well, certainly everyone's heard about the San Andreas Fault, and what some people don't realize is that the San Andreas Fault actually just delineates the Pacific Plate from the North American Plate. And so it just so happens that San Andreas runs right through the Bay Area.
Yeah.
And the San Andreas is the major fault, but there's plenty of other faults that accommodate the slip between the North American Plate and the Pacific Plate. It's just like if you have a cake and you shear a sheet cake, you might get one major break through the cake, but right next to that major break, you'll have a bunch of other smaller cracks.
So is it plate tectonics that causes earthquakes?
That's all plate tectonics. It's essentially the earth is trying to cool itself, and
It's slip sliding around, and
we just happen to be living right where it happens to be slipping laterally,
because horizontally. It's pretty. We have, you know, hills and water, and It makes for a really dramatic
So the reason that we like to live here is the reason it might be a problem.
Well, I mean, that I tell my friends and colleagues, I mean, this is the small price that we pay to live in such a beautiful area.
Here's the Hayward. Yep. Here's a video of the Hayward Fall in an earthquake. Proceeding down
can
the Hayward Fall.
Can you explain what, what's happening
here?
Sure,
I can. So what this is simulating, this is actually from a group from the USGS, and I'm going to give credit to Brad Agard, who is a seismologist there. And he actually coded this up, along with other seismologists, too. I don't want to just say it's just Brad, but it's mostly Brad. And what this is simulating is a magnitude 7 earthquake that starts from San Pablo Bay and ruptures south down towards Fremont. As you can see, the on the left-hand side, you've got the fault rupturing. Now, the fault has already finished unzipping, and the red area that you see there is essentially strong ground shaking that persists well after the fault has actually comes rupturing by you. And what it shows is essentially you get a lot of scattering and a lot of wave energy that still persists. And you can see the
Oakland still shaking. We're a minute in, minute
right,
seven
you can
in.
See the Oakland airport there in the foreground.
Not good.
And it's kind of scary the way it's shaking. It looks liquefied.
Well, yeah. Well, actually,
now, this is an exaggeration, right? I mean,
yeah.
This
well,
is
and
not...
it's exaggerated by a factor of 1,000.
Right.
Okay.
And actually, you can get all these videos from the USGS website. So
it's a great video.
You to
yeah.
Them and take a look.
And I really like it because we're north of that.
Well, okay. Well,
they don't show any shaking going north. Why is that?
What we didn't show is this is a view only from essentially San Francisco Bay looking east.
So we might feel a little shaking here.
Oh yeah. I mean, you live in a basin area, so yeah, you will feel something.
Yeah.
It may not be as bad.
So is it there are two plates that are up against one another, and the pressure is holding them together?
There's a vertical line. It's essentially, for all intents and purposes, it's a vertical line.
Okay.
But there is some compression across the fault too, and so right. As a result, you get hills. You get the Oakland, Berkeley, Hayward.
It's like a carpet that's getting rumpled up
a little bit. Most of the slip though is side to side, a horizontal slip, but mm-hmm. there is a little bit of compression, and so whenever the fault takes a turn, for example. You might get some mountain building. Santa Cruz Mountains is
right.
a good example.
And, of course, I was in a very bad earthquake, the Loma Prieta quake.
Right.
And hit Santa Cruz very, very hard
sure.
in 1989.
What was the magnitude of the Loma Prieta?
That was 6.9.
So
6.9.
So
that's right in the range of what
yeah, no, this
what,
is exactly
expected.
This is exactly the size that we're expecting now.
Mm-hmm.
For Loma Prieta, of course, that was way up in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and there weren't a whole lot of people that lived
right.
immediately next to it.
Right.
The concern, obviously, for the Hayward Fault is that now you have over 2 million people that essentially live right at ground zero.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, you have freeways that cross the fault. You have gas and electric power lines and water, of course. So there's going to be a lot of damage and a lot of chaos, and so at least the public safety people always say you should have at least 3 days worth of supplies mm-hmm. that you can be essentially self-sufficient. You know, have a tent, have
yeah.
water, have a bunch of food if you have little Coleman stoves and things like that for
Make
camping
sure.
and backpacking.
But, you know, can, most people take that stuff and they stuff it away in their garage somewhere.
I have these backpacks.
How do you know where to put that
well,
stuff so it's easily accessible when things have fallen down?
Right. Well, that's the big question. I mean, my wife and I have a few things in our car.
Right.
Fortunately, we live very close to our house. So, I mean, if we really needed to, we could get back to our house, I think, pretty
right.
easily just on foot.
Right.
But, you know, of course, you know, your kids are off different places. You know, they might be at school. They could be at a soccer field, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there could be some chaos.
We're seen all over the world. So not mm-hmm. everybody is in California
sure.
that's
yep.
watching this. Are earthquakes everywhere, or are they only in some areas?
Earthquakes tend to be concentrated in areas where there's a lot of plate movement. So
is that on continental edges? Is that where mountains are?
Yeah, well, you've heard of the Ring of Fire, and that's
yep.
obviously an area
where...
Pacific Rim, and that's essentially outlining the Pacific Plate, but where the Pacific Plate... arises and oops. And
so falls, there's often volcanism around it as well, volcanoes.
Sure. Yeah, whenever there's subduction, you've got the oceanic plate subducting underneath, let's say, the Aleutians in Alaska, underneath Japan. Material goes down deep, it melts and percolates up to the surface, and voila, you get a volcano.
But I've heard also that there have been volcanoes where Manhattan is today. I mean, you could have a volcano other areas,
they're,
too.
They're not as common, but yeah, you're right.
And that would be hideous. Because we in California have been preparing.
Right.
They never thought about an earthquake there.
Well, actually, that's not true. In New York, they do have some earthquakes. They're pretty small.
Right.
Yeah.
But the Eastern Seaboard does have earthquakes. They're just not as common.
Right.
And but when they do have them, a lot of people feel them from really far away. Mm-hmm. And that's a major distinction between the East Coast and West Coast. A magnitude 5, for example, in the East Coast can be felt for thousands of miles. 1,000 miles easily.
Just because of the nature of the
just
land?
Just because the crust there is a lot older and colder and a lot more efficient in propagating seismic energy. Whereas here, a magnitude 5 that happens, let's say, in San Jose, and we're sitting here in Petaluma.
We wouldn't feel it.
You wouldn't even feel it. You might feel it if you're on a tall building. You might feel some gentle swaying. Or if you had a pool, you could might see the pool kind of.
Water.
But as far as the high frequency shaking that would affect a building, you may not even feel it. And that's what we call attenuation. The attenuation here in the West Coast is totally different than it is in the East Coast.
Now, in the mid-continent, there are faults in the in the mid-continent, right? But are there just not as many, or are they just much older?
There was a failed rift. I mean, the New Madrid fault zone is the site of two very large earthquakes that happened in the early 1800s, I believe. I might not get my dates right. But essentially, that looks to be an area where the crust or the earth was attempting to form a new spreading center, and it failed for whatever reason. You know, tectonic forces change, and all of a sudden, one area just stops. But the fact that there's been big earthquakes there means that the likelihood of having other earthquakes in the future is high.
Huge.
There is a monitoring network out there, and they do see small earthquakes. And so the fear is that what happens if there's another large event there? You've gone 10 generations or more. No one's going to remember that there was a big earthquake.
Nobody's preparing. Yeah.
And the same is true, actually, for the Hayward Fault. I mean, 1868, that's six generations ago. No one that lives here now really has any idea that, you know, something big is going to happen unless maybe, you know, you get on the...
And we have so much, the building that has taken place since then is... It's grown by leaps in an exponential way, maybe.
Well, Simon Winchester, who wrote the book about the San Francisco earthquake, points out that some of the richest real estate in the Bay Area is right on the Hayward Fault. I mean, right on the Hayward Fault.
Yeah, which fault was responsible for the, was it 1906 earthquake?
That's the San Andreas.
The San Andreas fault. Okay. Yeah. And so we're really not expecting much from that.
Well, I mean, that's not my area of study.
Yours but from is the what, Hayward.
But no, well, not even that so much. But from what I've been told, I mean, the stress on the San Andreas Fault, at least on the northern San Andreas, really isn't nearly as high as, let's say, on the Hayward Fault.
So are we? So we're measuring it, and can we actually measure as the stress builds up and start to? I know we can't predict earthquakes, but we can kind of say, hey, it looks like something could be coming.
Well, unfortunately, as you said, we can't predict earthquakes. Right. I mean, there has been many universities and many different countries that have attempted to do that, and most of the evidence I've ever seen is pretty shaky.
Right.
No pun intended. but as far as the San Andreas goes, I think you know, they don't think there's a whole lot of worry, at least immediate worry. That's not to say that we're not going to have them within our lifetimes. I think just the probability, if you will, is higher.
But there is something to worry about with the Hayward.
Certainly. Oh, yeah, for the Hayward. Oh, yeah.
We're due.
For sure.
Here's for people who've never lived through an earthquake. This is video from Kobe, Japan TV station during an earthquake.
That, to me, the lab there is...
Lights are out. Everything's falling
over. If you play it again, there's a guy that was sleeping on a couch.
You can see him down in the bottom right.
He's shaking around.
Right. And I believe, I'm not positive, but I think this was actually a newsroom studio. So this guy had the night duty.
It's NHK,
Right. And this kind of speaks to bolting your furniture down. I mean, you can imagine, you know, if something were to fall on that poor guy that was sleeping, it wouldn't be good.
There's stuff. This stuff's moving 3 or 4 feet.
Right.
Yeah. And that's because the ground is shifting or 4 feet?
Well, also, he's in a building. So the building's going to amplify ground motion. So the higher you go, the larger the motion, too. One thing that this video points out as well is the fact that you really can't, if you're really in a strong earthquake,
nothing you can do.
Well, number one, you can't even get up and walk.
He clearly knows there's an earthquake. You can see him at the bottom of the screen. He knows there's an earthquake. Right. He's basically huddled.
Yeah, there's no way that you could stand up and walk to, let's say, to get underneath a door frame.
Right.
You essentially just have to find whatever's around you and go underneath it.
Shelter.
And hope that if there is a collapse, that whatever you're underneath also doesn't, you know, can give you enough cushion, in other words.
So in other words, if you were able to run to a door frame, it wasn't that bad.
Exactly. Now, that doesn't mean
because that's what we're taught to do, by the way.
Sure.
But
sure.
Now I know I'm just going to dive under this desk.
But, you know, there are cases when, let's say, the earthquake is far away. And, like, for example, Santa Cruz for the Loma Prieta, mm-hmm. people were able to walk around in, let's say, the San Francisco area. But the strong shaking was affecting buildings, and a lot of big plate glass windows were flying.
People died in San Francisco because brick walls that were unreinforced fell over.
And so they could still move. So you still have to be cognizant of, you know, maybe I shouldn't, you know, run out. Side screaming and you should look around.
Don't just run outside screaming.
You said the plate glass thing, and that's something that I hear a lot about in urban areas, that all this glass in these tall buildings might well be expected to break. In fact, I remember hearing a story that if there were a really bad earthquake downtown San Francisco, there'd be several feet
of glass,
of broken glass in the streets. I mean, that's pretty scary.
Yeah.
Now, I'm wondering about the dynamics of the earthquakes as mm-hmm. they happen. So if you have some, I guess, subduction, where you have a plate going underneath another mm-hmm. plate, you have where they're slipping sideways, you have
yes.
another where one is coming up over
right.
another.
So here in,
do those change the way the earthquakes happen?
I mean, for example, here in California, most of the faulting is side to side, or what we call strike slip. So one side of the plate or one side of the fault is moving, let's say, one direction mm-hmm. To the south, east, for example, for the Pacific plate in our case. Mm-hmm. For the North American plate. And the Pacific plate is kind of moving up towards the north and to the west.
Yep.
And they are just kind of sliding by. But in other areas like Japan, you have a lot of what's called subduction zone mm-hmm. earthquakes, and those are thrust faulting. And so you have the Pacific plate diving underneath essentially Japan and causing, essentially all of Japan is one big volcanic arc. It's one big line of volcanoes.
Wow.
There are some strike slip faults in the interior, but that's just residual stress resulting from the collision of those two plates. But the predominant is thrusting. In the Basin and Range in Nevada, for example, a lot mm-hmm. of the faulting there is normal faulting. In other words, it's kind of being pulled apart. So you have plates that are just, not plates, but faults that are accommodating extension. So in other words,
right.
if you pull apart the area, you get down drop blocks and things like that.
Yeah. Does the ground shake differently? I'm imagining there's got to be a certain frequency of vibration, or maybe side to side or up to down movement. It would be.
I think if you're looking at seismic waves from very far away, mm-hmm. what we call teleseismic, where we're using seismic stations around the globe, I think there is a predominant sort of ground motion for different events. But for the most part, I don't think, you know, the ground shaking is pretty. It's going to be pretty strong on all components, irrespective of the mechanism of the type of earthquake. It just turns out because the velocity of the Earth is lower at the surface of the Earth versus at depth, a lot of the seismic waves kind of turn up vertically, and a lot of the what's called the shear waves, the S waves that are what mm-hmm. is very damaging to buildings, is mostly on the horizontal component. So irrespective of really what the source did,
mm-hmm.
eventually a lot of the energy gets transferred to the horizontal components, which is bad for buildings and big structures, unfortunately.
Right.
Buildings are already withstanding 1G now standing up. So, you know, if they get pushed up or down, that's not so bad. But if they get pushed laterally at their base, then that's not as good.
We just recently celebrated is not the right word, the 20th anniversary of the Loma Prieta quake. And it was kind of fun on Facebook. All my friends and I also did this, put up stories of where we were in the quake and what a terrifying thing it was. I was at the World Series game at Pac Bell Park, Cal State Park, I guess it was then. And yeah, and I remember watching the light standards going like this and this and this and
I think
all.
There's a video.
There is, in fact,
of the some clips from.
Well, they had a lot of TV cameras there. Yeah. I think I'm not surprised.
Was it like the first most videotaped earthquake?
Must have been. I mean, gosh, it was a World Series game about
to
begin.
It did knock out a lot of power. I think there was only one news station that was actually up and running. Yeah. And
I remember driving back from, you know, we stayed at the park for a while, and it was actually very scary because people have TVs or radios, and they're screaming, "Oh my God, the Bay Bridge is falling!" And you don't know. There's not a lot of information, and there's a lot of rumor flying, and it was very terrifying. And then driving back to the city, and if you watch it on TV, it looked like it was a Holocaust. I mean, the whole city was burning, and it was just a few houses, a few areas. But did we learn anything from that quake? I mean, that's the biggest quake in my recent memory. Are we better prepared because of it?
Well, I think certainly, obviously, I think the bridge, the San Francisco Bay Bridge,
except for that retrofit they just did, which
from that, I think the main motivation for doing that was because that span
took them 20 years, though.
Yeah, well, I can't speak to that.
Better than nothing, I guess.
Right. So yeah. I think, you know, with the impending Hayward Fault earthquake, I think they're probably worried, you know.
You have a video at seismo.berkeley.edu, which is your page for the Seismographic Institute, a video for Cal students, a earthquake awareness video,
right?
Which is great, like preparing them what they need, what they should do.
This actually, this was done by I think Professor Richard Allen's students, and they made this actually a couple of years ago, and it's actually really well done. And so, yeah, I encourage people if they can hit our outreach page. There's actually a whole slide presentation for kids that are kind of geared for sixth graders. So it puts it in very simple terms, and you can download them. And there's another set of PowerPoint talks that you can click through that are more for the general audience. Mm-hmm. Like, why do we have earthquakes? Why do we have earthquakes here in this particular area? What you can do? And
you can also download this for your iPod and watch it over and over again.
Everything is open. But it is, at least for the outreach part, it's very Hayward Fault specific. But there's general information in there as well. Actually, my students had a great time filming Seismo Susie on the front page, where they got my daughter's doll and essentially put her in a shake table that the Lawrence Hall of Science has.
That simulates...
It simulates ground motion, and you can see the effect of when you tie down furniture versus not.
I'm going to find that. Okay, I'm on the front page.
It's on the front page.
And there's education and outreach. And I go to the outreach? There it is. Okay, yeah, Seismo Susie.
It says, watch Seismo Susie. Unfortunately, there's no audio, but I think we're planning to put that on there.
Well, I think it'll be enough just to watch Seismo Susie shake and quake here.
Right.
This is a shake table. Seismo Susie learns earthquake safety.
Right.
In Seismo Susie's unretrofitted house, a large earthquake hits.
Oh, cute.
First of all, there goes the water heater. Bookshelf next.
Bookshelf.
There goes Susie. We've strapped our water heater. We have a wrench to turn off the gas.
Oh, that's good.
They handed those out right after the 1989 quake, and I remember I worked at the radio station in San Francisco at the time, and we did a bunch of events encouraging people to do things like strapping. Right. See, her heater's strapped now. It's not going anywhere.
The bookshelf only thing attached not strapped to the wall. Down was Susie in this
Susie
case.
Still fell over, but you know, that's not so bad.
And I think this other one is Susie...
gets out of the table.
doing the right thing here.
Yep.
Yep, there she goes.
Oh, and you know what? It's good she was there.
Protected by the table.
Yeah.
Good.
So we don't have a... Ozzy, it's okay. There's not an earthquake. That's just Susie. It was simulated, Ozzy. It's going to be all right. My dog has never lived through an earthquake. He doesn't know. For anybody who's been in an earthquake, and I know most of the people watching have not, it is very scary because the one thing you don't expect to move is the ground. Yeah. It's what should be stable.
There's a lot of noise, too. People don't realize that.
There's a rumbling and a...
Well, it's usually the building that you're hearing. It's not really the earthquake itself. It's the effect of the earthquake on the structures that you're in. But
safer in a tall high-rise or in a wood frame building, or is it...
For me, I'd rather be in a wood frame building.
On solid rock.
On bedrock.
On bedrock.
Yeah. You know, it's really funny because once you've lived through a quake, we live on a hill on bedrock because it's a, certainly a psychological, I probably wasn't the first criterion, but it was a criterion for a house.
Right. I'm wondering about the science of predicting earthquakes. I mean, how far has technology and science come, say, in the last 20 years since Loma Prieta to actually, I mean, we've got these percentages. I mean, how are we coming up with these numbers, and are they really?
I mean, okay. Well, when you say prediction, I'm going to...
I think of a crystal ball and...
Right. Well, probably those of us that have lived around here have heard of people saying, oh, there's going to be an earthquake, next week with a high probability. But that's usually not based a lot in science. At least none of my colleagues would think that.
Right.
The Hayward Fault, for example, is a good example of a case where people have done what's called paleo trenching, where they've actually get a backhoe and they actually just dig a ditch along the fault, and they're looking at breaks in the fault. Essentially, they're mapping out different sedimentary layers within the fault, and if it happens to have organic material that's in it, you can carbon date it. Well, if you can see enough breaks in enough different spots along the fault, you can tie them together and figure out, oh, okay, there must have been a big event that was maybe 20, 30 kilometers long in extent, because it seems to show up in every single trench that we've dug. And so there's a whole group down at the USGS that does that, and there's other groups down at Caltech as well. So that is what I would call more earthquake prediction, in the sense that they're looking at past earthquakes and saying, well, and inferring, well, something big is likely to happen.
And if you see some kind of a pattern emerging over time,
right,
you're probably going to...
It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that, oh, maybe something's going to happen soon.
Right.
Right, right. So... but as far as new technology, I think that's one of the big things that people are kind of looking to. As far as predictions that, let's say, you think something's going to happen in 2 days from now, I think maybe if there was a swarm of earthquakes that just happened to pop up on the Hayward Fault that just kept going and going and going, maybe that would give us pause. But as far as...
Right.
Predicting, I think we're far away from that. I think you're far better off actually accepting the fact that something big is going to happen and do all the preventative things that you possibly can. And that's both as a family, as a family, as let's say administrators and government officials.
In other words, just assume it's going to happen.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter when, just be ready now.
We know it's going to happen, but one of the issues is just trying to get the word out that, as I was pointing out, there's been multiple generations of people that have lived in the Bay Area that have really not felt anything of size. I mean, even Loma Prieta, as big as and as damaging as that was, it was far away. It was quite far away.
Right.
So
for a lot of people, I was at least felt it. It was not my first. My mom lives in Santa Cruz. No, our whole downtown was destroyed in Santa Cruz.
I never felt it.
It's actually kind of amazing. I mean, when I grew up in Santa Cruz, I went to high school in Santa Cruz. We had a wonderful downtown with bookshops and cafes and the Cooper House where a band would play.
Sure, yeah.
All destroyed.
Destroyed.
It's gone now.
Yeah.
Because it was all brick and it fell down.
Mm-hmm.
And that really brings it home when you go back to your hometown and the main street is gone.
Right.
You know that the earthquake has a lot. And that really, I mean, we could have a stronger earthquake even than that, right? I mean, that wasn't a killer earthquake.
That was about 10 times smaller than the 1906 earthquake in length.
It's logarithmic. So each point on the Richter scale is
about a factor of 10 in amplitude.
10 times stronger. Okay.
Or so, but just the length, the extent of the fault that ruptured in Loma Prieta was about a tenth of what.
Oh, it was small.
Yeah, very small. Small, but it's still...
Those of us who live in the Bay Area, things like the Bolinas Lagoon, which was created by the 06 earthquake, well, those of us who live in the Bay Area see the results of earthquake all the time, but are not aware of it.
You know, there's a bunch of lakes, linear lakes, like San Andreas Lake, long linear lakes that essentially are right up against the fault, and it's a constant reminder.
Yeah, geologists look at them and go, I know what that is.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, what about induced earthquakes, or where you have maybe fault loading from another seismic event on another fault. I mean, you have all these plates and things.
Yeah, they're all jostling around.
Right.
Well, what we did see after Loma Prieta is that there was a lot of activity on the other faults immediately after.
Oh, interesting. I guess that makes sense.
So clearly, you know, it's all connected.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So within the Bay Area, I think there were some seismicity studies that did find that, yeah, the Hayward Fault and Calaveras and other faults, they kind of lit up, if you will.
Yeah.
People have thought, well, when we had the big earthquake in Sumatra, you know, does that affect things over here? And the answer is, I don't think so.
Nor does it relieve tension over here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's all connected in a broader sense. But as far as a seismicity rate increase here in the Bay Area, no.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know.
There are always earthquakes. I mean, I'm looking at the map at the U.S. Geological Survey of today's seismic activity. Today alone, 806 earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
In California.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't felt a single one.
Well, they're all very, very small, right?
All small, yeah. Not all, but yeah.
Most too small to notice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then also the difference between, say, deep fault movement and surface movement. Do you know if there's some kind of a difference in how this is there movement down deep that loads things up or releases the pressure?
Well, certainly the driving mechanism for all of these faults is coming from below the crust, and the crust is sort of passively kind of moving along and getting jostled about. In some areas it sticks and forces build up, and then you have an earthquake.
Yeah.
There are some faults that do creep. In other words, they kind of just slide along without having a really big earthquake, and others, they lock, and you won't have any movement for several decades or more, and then all of a sudden, in one catastrophic event, you have one big earthquake, right? So the area of the Hayward Fault right near the Berkeley Stadium, for example, is creeping, but below that, or south and east of that, it's not. So it just so happens that part is creeping, but... You know, one could make the argument, well, if it's creeping, then it means it's not building up stress. Well, maybe not there, but stress is building up in other parts. And, for example, there was a magnitude 4 or so earthquake that happened a couple of years ago in where I live in the Oakland Hills. And a lot of my neighbors said, oh, well, that's a good thing because now it relieves stress because, you know, this magnitude 4, and unfortunately you'd need, you know, thousands of those to equal a magnitude 7 that we know is coming. So It relieves stress, yes. Is it significant? Absolutely not.
Not.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Okay. So we know that it's not. Those smaller quakes aren't.
You can just do the math. It just doesn't. The amount of energy that's released by magnitude 4 is just too small.
So, right.
But it does serve a purpose. It does actually give you a wake-up call. I mean, this little magnitude 4 broke a lot of windows and knocked over, you know, little vases and things like that in people's homes in that little town of Montclair up in the hills.
Yeah.
And that was a good wake-up call.
You know what's neat about the internet is USGS has, I'm starting to browse through their webpage, and among other things, they have real-time seismographs that are updated regularly. Mm-hmm. So you can see the activity.
Yeah.
It's changed so much in 20 years. People now, when there's an earthquake, immediately go to the internet.
Sure.
And go to the USGS and see, well, how bad was it? How bad was it? Mm-hmm. You know, and...
They even have shake maps and things like that to tell you exactly, okay, what is the expected shaking in your particular area?
Of course, by the time it's happened, it's really...
Well, it's actually valuable for, emergency services people.
They need to know where it's
They'd like to know after the fact, okay, it looks like this particular area was hit hardest, and maybe there's not actual reports yet because
phones are out,
lines are down, and so it allows them to essentially go in there.
I remember very well, I was working at KNBR, which is the EBS, I think the EBS number 2 station, the emergency broadcast system goes off, you set off the tones that you never want to hear in your whole life, and we broadcast pretty much nonstop in shifts, and there was a lot to talk about. A lot of people didn't know where their families were. I didn't know what happened to my mother because we couldn't talk to her because she was in Santa Cruz. The phones were out.
Right. So it'll be interesting if, you know, with everyone having a cell phone.
It's changed a little bit now.
Will cell phones go down, and, you know, to what extent can you, in the old days, they always used to tell you, well, call someone out of state because those lines will be open.
Will be open.
I have no idea if that's the case now.
It's in the chat room. Darth Emma,
who is a geologist.
She's a geologist. Oh, okay. She's been very. She's been into this conversation. She says fault creep is good.
Fault creep is good.
Fault creep for the win.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't think there's enough of it for us to.
Does it relieve tension? Is that why it's good?
Sure,
what is it?
It's obviously relieving.
It's like small little.
Right. But there's many areas of the San Andreas fault system that isn't creeping, unfortunately. Yeah.
I loved the Simon Winchester book. He was trained as a geologist. I don't know if you've read it about the 1906 quake, but it's really instructive on how earthquakes. The mechanism and minute by minute recreation of what happened in 1906. And there were only a few trained observers at the time, but it was just fascinating to read about it. And then, of course, modern earthquakes, there's a lot more video and recordings and seismographic readings and so forth. What's the worst quake that's been in the last recent memory? Have there been any really bad ones?
Well, obviously the
Indonesia.
The Indonesia.
Yeah.
That was a 9.1, 9.2.
But that's unimaginable.
That was the fault where it occurred. It was underwater. It caused a tsunami.
Yeah, it was a thrusting subduction zone.
So nobody felt the 9 really. It was the tsunami that really was the impact. Or
well, yeah, I think people did feel the earthquake, but
that
what everyone knows about is the tsunami. That happened.
9. I don't think we would have a very good result here in California if we had anything that strong.
Essentially, a 9, if you're right next to it, you're only going to feel the patch of the fault that's kind of closest to you.
Right.
So ground motion-wise, it kind of is similar to a magnitude 6.5
or so. Oh, I see.
It's just that its duration goes on.
It goes on and on and on.
Those of us that look at sort of magnitudes and stuff, we're looking at the total fault area and how much it slipped as a measure of true size.
I see.
So if you were to actually use the Richter magnitude on that event, it probably wouldn't have been over maybe a 7 or so.
I see.
But if you look at what's called the moment magnitude, which is what we use, that really gets to the physics.
That's how much energy is released almost, right?
It's essentially telling you the total area that was involved in the earthquake and how far on average did the thing slip and how quickly. Yeah. But even like for the 1906 earthquake, as bad as it was, I mean, it ruptured a significant section well to the north of San Francisco, but those people really weren't.
It was rural area. That's why the Bolinas Lagoon is there, but, you know, there wasn't anybody really, you know, caring too much about it.
The house.
Geologically, it's just the entire western coast of California is fascinating because if you think about what rocks are where they are, like, there are rocks that should be down in Southern California or at least closer to the Central Coast that are now much further north as a result of the
plate tectonics. You know, people were wondering, they would, not just here in California, but other parts of the world, they were realizing, okay, there's all kinds of weird observations that we're finding, and that kind of added to the whole theory of plate tectonics.
It's neat being able to go out and observe something and come up with, now that we understand, we can go back and say, okay, that's how it moved here and why this is where it is.
Sometimes they say California is going to fall into the ocean. Is that true?
I don't think so.
Okay.
There's a really good book. John McPhee has a
book. He's great.
And I encourage all the listeners out there to read those books, especially Assembling California is a really good book. And essentially, just for very simple lay terms, how California came to be, for example.
You have to love geology if you read John McPhee because he's very detailed. But if you love that
there's
stuff.
There's Basin and Range, I think, is another
one. It's amazing.
He's can't
incredible.
Get my kids to read it, so maybe you have to be an earth scientist.
It's hard work because he loves detail and it's very detailed. But boy, he's
an excellent writer.
He really knows how to capture
right
what's happening on.
Now there's been some recent research that's come out like in the last week or two, at least papers that have been published that have been kind of interesting to me relating to. The aftershocks of earthquakes and how they appear, and one recent study suggests that in the the center of the continent, we have these aftershocks that might be occurring on a very, very long time frequency that we're looking at them and going, oh, it's just a little earthquake, but really maybe it's an aftershock from like 100 years, from an earthquake, a big earthquake 100 years ago.
Yeah, I actually wasn't familiar with that particular study until you brought it up, actually. You're doing more seismology reading than I am. but yeah, it turns out sort of the definition of sort of an aftershock sequence is that it's usually smaller events occurring after a big event and decreasing exponentially with time.
Right. So you expect that you have a big quake and then a little and little and little,
so
and it kind of
sort of the rule of thumb is if you have a magnitude 7 earthquake, you might get, you know, a magnitude 6 or so aftershock and maybe several magnitude 5s, and it gets more and more. But with increasing time, you get less and less of them. The size goes down. So you don't expect a magnitude 6 to happen, let's say, you know, after a magnitude 7.
Right.
Many, many years later, you'd almost call that a new event.
Right.
For these big earthquakes, like for the big Indonesian earthquake, I think, you know, technically they're still having aftershocks. If you plot the number of events versus time, they still fall on what we determined to be, you know, kind of an exponentially decaying
geologic timescale is not our timescale. Yeah. It's a very different
timescale. This is just a few years, and maybe for the central part of the U.S., that's still the case. Maybe, you know, stresses get relieved and redistributed, that could very well be an aftershock sequence or part of that larger sequence.
Here's some good news. The John McPhee books are on half-price sale at audible.com. And this would be a good way, actually, to read them, is to listen to them in your car. So it's Basin and Range is the first one, In Suspect Terrain, and then Rising from the Plains. Mm-hmm. Would be really good books, and they're half-price, so...
Yeah.
I'm going to add them to my list. I've been meaning to read them. Every time I dip into them, I go, oh, I think I'll save this for another day, but I think this would be a good time to read it.
Yeah, I remember, not by John McPhee, but I read an article at one point about the forces that have gone into creating the hills that are to the east here through like Fairfield and from here outward to Fairfield, and the transpressive forces that have been in place. So basically taking the earth and just crumpling it up. And like Leo said earlier, kind of like a rug crumpling up, or if you take a piece of paper and scrunch it and you end up with like all these ridges. Just to think, it's mind-bending sometimes to take the solid earth and to wrap your head around the idea that, okay,
it's pliable.
It's pliable.
Right. Over geologic time, all that stuff.
It's like liquid over geologic time. It's like a drink of water.
which is a completely different perspective on it, and it's and to be able to take a look at the Earth with a scientific eye from that perspective, I think it's fascinating.
Oh yeah, I got a little bit about that from my dad, who's a paleontologist and a geologist. We couldn't drive by a road cut, an outcropping, without stopping. The hand lens and the pick coming out. Got
to
check it out. But that, it's interesting because those outcrops really are evidence of all of this. You can read the record there. And it's just fascinating, you know.
What got you into earthquakes? Is it the Bay Area in general?
You know, that's a very good question. I was born in the Bay Area. I actually had a great-grandmother that went through the 1906 earthquake.
Wow.
And she was just a little girl. But I think I've told this story a number of times to some friends of mine, but... our family lived up in the Oakland Hills, and we were having one of these family dinners, and there was probably the equivalent of a magnitude 3 that just happened to occur close to us, and it was one of these bone jarring, but only lasted about a second
really
kind of thing, and everyone looked at each other, and my great grandmother was looking there, going, "Oh, that was small,
nothing. What are you crazy?
What are you talking about?
Are you guys nuts?"
And she then went into this long story about how when she was a little girl, she remembers the 1906 earthquake.
Oh, well, that's neat.
From what I recall, she didn't remember the actual shaking, but she remembers the fire, which persisted for days following the earthquake. And so...
that's often the case, isn't it? It's not necessarily the shaking. It's the tsunami or the fire or the destruction after the earthquake.
Yeah, I guess it just depends on the situation. Yeah. Kobe, for example, that was all the shaking.
It was all shaking.
Yeah, it was all shaking.
Oh,
and or in Italy recently, there was the big earthquake in L'Aquila that flattened that little town outside of Rome. So that story kind of got me thinking. And then when I went off to college, I as most undergraduates, I had no idea what I wanted to do.
So right.
I took a math course, I took a physics course, and I took a geology course as a freshman. And you put all three of those together, you come up with geophysics.
Right.
And one subset of geophysics is seismology.
Fantastic.
And just continued with that at Berkeley and still didn't know what I wanted to do
right.
after finishing up as an undergrad. And then went off, well, what else do? You go to grad school. And so
yeah.
I went off to grad school at USC, and the rest is history.
That's so neat.
Yeah.
Terry, Darth Emma in our chat room says that the San Francisco quake was called the fire so that people would reinvest in San Francisco. Fire, they figured, well, fire can happen, but a quake, that might happen again. So we'll call it a fire.
Oh my goodness.
Makes sense.
And in if you just go to Google and look up earthquakes, the very top of the page, it says it has a list of the recent earthquakes that have taken place, big earthquakes that have taken place in the world. 4 hours ago, there was a magnitude 5.4 earthquake in southern Sumatra, Indonesia.
Wow.
Definitely an aftershock.
Yep. That's a big aftershock.
Then there were, I guess, just a couple of weeks ago, there were some big events in Vanuatu and yeah. you know, that area.
That really is the ring of fire.
That's still
isn't
ring
it?
Of
yeah.
fire.
Yeah. That area always gets
earthquakes. Yeah,
and some of them are deeper, so oftentimes you don't get a lot of damage. But there was that one event in American Samoa, I believe, that had the small tsunami.
And let's not forget mm-hmm. Krakatoa, east of Java. No, I'm sorry, that's
volcanic.
A movie. Yeah, that's all the same,
it
right?
It was real.
It's all the same. NIJ wants to know in our chat room if you think it is possible at any time, will we ever be able to predict quakes?
You know, unfortunately, this is the pessimist in me. I'm sorry. And this is strictly my own view. Earthquakes nucleate at depth several miles below us. And it's really hard to see, you know, how you can even measure something mm-hmm. that's nucleating at such depth. There is one occurrence, I think, in China where the Chinese government noticed a bunch of unusual things happening, and they cleared out a town, and shortly thereafter, there was a huge earthquake that leveled the town.
Hmm. Wow.
But there have been, you know, 100 other examples right. where that isn't the case, and right. you know, the earthquake happened. So was it luck? I don't know. Some people were looking at radon gas coming out of wells. Others were, you know, animals. But as I said before, I think you're far better off if you're in earthquake country, just assume it's going to happen and prepare for it.
Yeah.
I mean, it is interesting. I mean, who wouldn't love to predict an earthquake? But,
you know, almost it wouldn't be a good thing though. I mean, what are you going to do? Even if we knew there was going to be an earthquake tomorrow.
Well, if you knew there were going to be an earthquake on a particular day, I say a large earthquake, 7 or greater mm-hmm. here in the Bay Area, maybe on the Hayward Fault, you could have a week's notice to get people out of the area
right.
to shut down, to say, okay, it's going to happen on this day. We're going to shut down the freeways.
Right. But you can imagine, though, with every third person in the Bay Area being an attorney, if that happened,
chaos.
What would yeah. happen?
And you better not be wrong.
But actually, I mean, there are other kinds of sort of cutting-edge research that's occurring now, and that's kind of early warning prediction.
Yeah.
And that is Professor Richard Allen, again, at Berkeley, is devised a methodology that actually, I think, is being studied also by groups at Caltech mm-hmm. and in Japan. Different variants, but essentially what they're looking at is when the earthquake happens, what can you tell in the first few seconds when you're looking at the initial P waves, the first waves that get emanated from the earthquake? Can you tell how big the earthquake's going to be? And it may give you a few tens of seconds of warning. And so
right.
because the Bay Area fortunately has many, many stations, you know, you could in real time, you can be sensing these waves.
Yeah.
And then you can make a prediction, a forward prediction of, okay, I think I'm seeing a really large magnitude event. It's going to be at least greater than a 5. Maybe with another second, you think you can ratchet up your prediction. And if that's the case, then you can do things like maybe shut down BART, open up garage doors of fire stations, or
right.
mobilize ambulances. Just with, you know, there's a fair amount of stuff you can do in 10 seconds. But,
I don't know how to turn off this phone.
Oh,
hi, Jennifer.
The side one.
There you go. I don't have an iPhone, everyone. I admit it.
It's just a matter of time.
Yeah. So yeah, but having that kind of, just that small amount of time to be able to do something that could help with the what we have to go through afterwards.
Right.
And so that's interesting that there is cutting edge research that's taking place now that's looking at those possibilities.
Yeah, I think, you know, the fact that you have a lot of big things that are moving around in major metropolitan cities, the fact that we have very high speed internet and communication services and computer processors are really fast now.
Yeah.
And the sensors that we put in the ground are much, much better than they were, you know, several decades ago. I mean, all of that is leading towards this sort of real time sort of ground motion prediction, if you will.
Right. Yeah. What do you think about the ideas that when you remove water from an area, or I've heard,
right.
So it's a water putting
right.
pressure on the ground when it gets moved away,
well, there's
just
plenty
say, like, tidal forces
right.
or whatever.
There's plenty of examples, let's say, of someone builds a dam,
yeah.
some country, and you start slowly filling up this dam, and all of a sudden you get some micro seismic activity underneath the dam. And that usually lasts for a while and then it ends. But it,
okay.
people that
everything
live,
has to shift around a
right,
little
well,
bit.
Well, you have a lot of loading. You know, the water's heavy and now you've loaded a part of the earth that didn't necessarily have a whole lot of weight on it.
Yeah.
And so there might be some residual stresses that need to be relieved. And that extra bit of water is just enough to push those little faults over the edge. And of course the big worry is, oh, you're going to trigger a big earthquake.
Yeah,
that
people have said that it's
as far
like,
as
oh.
I know that's not happened. The same is true even for more for oil industry related mm-hmm. activities like hydrofracking, where they're actually injecting water at high pressure
mm-hmm.
underground to make cracks and to allow oil and whatnot to migrate easier.
Yeah.
They do see a little bit of seismic activity that comes up. And I think most of the oil companies that I think that are doing that do monitor the seismic activity.
I hope so.
Geothermal fields, for example, do that.
There's one suggested up in the, just up north of
in the like, geysers.
Yeah, in the geyser area. Right. And there's actually been, there have been a bunch of people who are against it because of the company that's bringing it here to the Northern Bay area actually did some work similar geothermal hydrothermal mm-hmm. work in Switzerland and
yeah.
there was a huge earthquake that
in Switzerland
I think it was in Switzerland and it was and they tied or this is some research is possibly tying the earthquake that took place to the geothermal
right.
work that they were doing because they're going into an area that has you know has hot water basically it has
oh, and they're extracting it.
And they're extracting and they're using it for power to get
right.
to gain
turbines
power.
And whatnot, yeah. right.
But possibly because if they're pumping more water down there, doing some or drilling, maybe they're going to affect any small faults.
I guess
there's
always that possibility. And I think, you know, that's
yeah.
why a lot of these companies I think are actually doing active monitoring to make sure that, you know, if there's anything funny happening or unusual happening, right?
I don't know. I think it hasn't been that long that people have had to think of the engineering that we do and the effects of that engineering on the earth in terms
sure.
of actually having a huge effect, like triggering an earthquake
mm-hmm.
or, you know, changing the weather in some way. These are things that suddenly we're dealing with engineering problems that are on a very global or a larger scale than we've ever had to before. And so I don't know if we've switched our mindset to actually take those things into account.
Yeah. As far as I know, at least for some of the man-made things that we're doing, I can't recall of any example where a major earthquake was triggered because
right.
of that. I without a doubt, there's a lot of micro seismic activity, but nothing that would be of damage. Now, that's not to say that won't happen, but
right.
I mean, presumably, maybe you wouldn't want to fill up a dam right on a large loaded fault. It may not be a good idea,
but I bet somebody has.
Yeah, I mean, people. I remember in a graduate class, one of the professors who will remain anonymous had said, "Oh, well, you know, why don't we, you know, if you inject water at high pressure on the San Andreas Fault, you could trigger a small event. And if you do that in enough places, you could get enough of these events
to release the stress.
The problem is that what if you do it? What if it runs away?
What if you really trigger a quake?
Oopsie. Hey, let's try it.
Oopsie. I mean, in addition to be completely economically unfeasible, but you know, if you're a, you know, but
interesting ideas from. See, that's the thing where you have to have the discussion to take place to, you know, have these interesting ideas come out, and every idea should have its place and its time in the discussion. But maybe that some ideas are just not ideas that we should really consider.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry too much about that.
Yeah. Right. It's been fabulous talking with you. This has been a great subject.
It really is.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you so much for all the information.
And for the videos.
The videos, the information on earthquakes. I think seismic activity is... I mean, there's plate tectonics active. Plate tectonics are active all over the globe, wherever there's crust.
That's right.
Wherever there's crust, there's quakes.
The Ring of Fire. I'm choosing San Francisco as my home base for now. I probably will not move to Seattle. I've heard too many terrible potential things that could happen.
Really? Could there be earthquakes in Seattle?
Mm-hmm. It's big Ring of Fire. I mean, you've got all the mounts.
Yeah, Mount St. Helens.
Mount Rainier. Yeah. I mean, all the mount, big mountains.
There's subduction going on there.
Yes. Yeah, up there. I like hiking, but I'm not going to stay there for any length of time.
But, you know, as long as you choose a house that's safe, you know. Like I say, it's a small price we pay to live in a pretty area.
In a very pretty area. Some people choose their tornadoes and their... You know,
there's something everywhere, isn't there? There's something everywhere. You could be in New Orleans. You could find Kevin's work at the Berkeley Seismological Laboratory page, which is seismo.berkeley.edu. And the outreach page is over here on the left, Education and Outreach. And that's where you can find Seismic Susie and Seismo Susie and all the other information. And, of course, information for teachers, for adults, and preparing for an earthquake. Which is something I guess anybody who lives in earthquake country should be doing.
Yeah, is there any place else that people can should look for you or look for other information?
Well, certainly for more information, the USGS website is a great resource. Yeah. I mean, this particular website we set up specifically more for people that live in the East Bay.
Yeah.
But I think the USGS is a fantastic resource.
And you know what? There's stop, drop, and roll for fires, but it's stop, drop, and cover for earthquakes. Just remember that and hold on.
That's right.
Is it for an earthquake? It's the same as for nuclear bombs.
I think there's not much you can do if there's a nuclear bomb, but you know, you might as well be under a table as anywhere else. It's not going to make that much difference.
Yeah, that's a different show.
Yeah, that's another show for another time. Kevin, nice to meet you. Thank you for coming in. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, fascinating stuff.
And you can find more science. I do more science at This Week in Science, which if you go to twist.org, that is a website for This Week in Science. Dr. Kiki Science Hour is here on Twit every Thursday afternoon from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And... Thanksgiving is probably going to be a rerun.
We're going to take Thanksgiving off, I think.
We're going to take Thanksgiving off. Yeah. But next week, we are going to be talking with an expert from up in Oregon about the Oregon dead zones.
What?
Yes. There are dead zones, oceanic dead zones.
Oh, interesting.
Areas of very low oxygen.
Lack of nightlife.
Yeah. That's right. You go certain places, lack of nightlife.
Yeah. Yeah.
San Francisco some evenings, even.
So that's next Thursday.
Next Thursday, we're talking about dead zones.
Is the following week Thanksgiving? Is that
the following week is Thanksgiving.
Wow,
and then in the future, I'm working on getting Carolyn Porco from NASA to talk about the Cassini mission.
Oh, that's
great. And Saturn and Enceladus and all these fun space things. I've got a science comedian coming to join us. We're also going to be talking about the science in the movies. I've got all sorts of things lined up, and I'm trying to get things scheduled for, you know, a good long time. We have exciting shows coming up. You can find me also on the internet, Twitter, drkiki. I am also drkiki at twit.tv.
You can email her.
email with ideas for people you'd like to see interviewed here.
Yep. I like the current Dr. Kiki picture. You change your picture a lot on Twitter.
I changed my picture.
And
yes,
that one is wild.
If you click on it, it was from a costume party. You were supposed to come as a character.
You are a character. There's no doubt about that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kiki.
Thanks, Leo.
Yeah. We'll see you next time on this lovely Kiki Science Hour.